Brian Rigg. Is it Mark Brian Rigg or Brian Mark Rigg?
I think it's Brian Mark Rigg.
Okay. Brian Mark Rigg. And it says in there that it goes through all the top level generals. Milch, I think, was a Jewish. He was head of the Air Force, I believe.
Yeah, Milch.
Many sources say that Heydrich, who was the head of the SS, was Jewish.
He absolutely was. His father was Bruno Zuse.
Okay. And then you have Adolf Eichmann spoke Yiddish. Adolf Eichmann was going back and forth to Palestine all the time.
And repeatedly declared that he was a Zionist.
Please?
He repeatedly declared that he himself was a Zionist.
Okay. And Eichmann also, I didn't know that, Eichmann also looks very Jewish if you look at pictures of him. The book I was referring to before is called Special Treatment, The Untold Story of Hitler's Third Race by Alan Abrams. And it's about all these exceptions that Hitler made to half-Jewish individuals, which just blows the smithereens the idea that he was trying to kill every Jew in the world, or even, even going after any kind of type of a mass extermination, even though, by my thinking, there was, when the infighting broke out between, which I think did happen, although you may have a different take on it, the Rakowski in the Rakowski interrogations talks about the infighting that breaks out between Hitler, Stalin, and the bankers, and I believe that did happen. I believe that Hitler, when he realized he was being checkmated out of a place in the New World Order, in other words, when, at least according to my mentor, when Hitler invaded Poland and Stalin invaded Poland, both from different sides, one from Russia from the east and Germany came in from the Nazis came in from the west, and then the Western press attacked Hitler and did not attack Stalin. They really whooped it up against Hitler. They did not attack Stalin for.
Now that's very important because the invasion of Poland was used because of the treaties between Poland, France, and England as a reason for the West to initiate a war against Germany. Now, they had the same treaty to protect them from the Soviets, but they did not attack the Soviets. Well, they did attack Germany. And
so,
many
yes.
people believe that Hitler was surprised when he was attacked by England and France.
Well, Hitler, in any case, when he saw that he was the odd man out, he, according to my mentor, he believes that Hitler, a fight did begin then, infighting, and one of the things Hitler realized was that the communist Jews, the socialist Jews, were his greatest threat, and so he did begin rounding them up and did begin working them to death on small calories in the concentration camps. Of course, I believe that the deliberate allowing many Jews to die in these camps that were not wanted for Palestine was part of the plan, because it fulfilled several very critical things for the Zionists. One, it has allowed them to have an event which they can try. They're trying to supplant the crucifixion of Christ with the Holocaust as the greatest victimhood event in history. Secondly, it gives them a club to use against the non-Jewish peoples in one sense, and against the everyday Jewish peoples in another sense. A club of guilt, though, against the non-Jewish peoples, that they're hoping they can fasten on for the rest of eternity to get their way and to prevent any criticism. So for today, if someone like me says, hey, we don't really, this doesn't feel good, this doesn't look good that all of the major media in the United States, all the big TV stations, all the major radio talk stations are owned by Jews or controlled by Jews, then immediately they scream, Holocaust! That guy obviously wants to light up a gas oven and kill Jews. So the Holocaust has served many great psychological propaganda strategies for the top Zionists. And you probably are aware of the book called The First 6 Million, which is written, it's a book that you can find on the internet, and it's about how in 1919 and early 20s there were the various Jewish publications, including the New York Times, once floated the idea that 6 million Jews were dying in Germany right after World War One. Well, they quickly retracted from this because it obviously wasn't going to be going to fly. And
well,
really,
if I may interject, there,
yeah.
this all plays into Judaist mythology that they have to atone for their initial sins, and the reason why they were not allowed back into Palestine and why they were initially expelled by the Romans was the fact that they were not obedient to God and had not obeyed God's laws. Mm-hmm. And they had long been stating that there would have to be some horrific event that would punish the Jews in order to give them atonement so that God would allow them to return to the Promised Land. Mm-hmm. That's one aspect of it. Another aspect of it is that the Zionists openly stated, Zionists such as David Ben-Gurion, who became Prime Minister of Israel, that they did not want the dead weight of masses of Jews. They would prefer that those Jews be killed off by Hitler, and that they would only get the best Jews, the young, healthy Jews, who through a process of natural selection would be the finest Jews to come down to Palestine. And yeah, they had long been stating that Palestine could support no more than, say, 1.5 million Jews total.
I see.
So there's no need to speculate about their motivations, because they openly stated that they did not want all the Jews to survive the war. They only wanted a handful of Jews to survive the war.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, this raises, Rakowski interrogation says that infighting broke out, and you know, that may be the case. I'll say here what I don't even know if I said on the DVD, but you could also make possibly a case, even though this will, we can hear the neo-Nazis from the 70s screaming at the top of their lungs as I say this, that Hitler was simply all the way along working out the strategy with the bankers, and was not really, except for maybe some dust-ups and skirmishes, really opposing them in any significant way, because, you know, one of my friends, who's an older German guy, says the Jews cannot stop romanticizing World War II. You know, there's a joke that the History Channel should be renamed the Hitler Channel, because they run so much Nazi stuff on the. And the point is, if you look at it as a play, a fatal or a murderous play where 60, 70 or whatever it was million people died, it worked out perfect. It almost worked out perfect for.
Well, look at the end result of the war. Germany was destroyed. Communism spread throughout Eastern Europe, which was the goal of the communists. Hitler was a communist. Hitler issued the Nero Order, demanding that all Germans kill themselves.
What?
Yes.
I never want. Tell us all about that.
Well, he went on the radio saying that in this Darwinistic struggle between races, the Germans had failed, and therefore the Germans ought to commit suicide, and Germany should be destroyed. And Hitler...
Well, that goes a long way towards convincing me that he was really never out of step with his backers.
And Goebbels pursued the same policy, and Hitler ensured that Germany would lose the war and would be destroyed. When America was attacked by Japan and declared war on Japan, Germany declared war on America, which was completely unnecessary. And
right.
Hitler was a veteran of the First World War and knew that war with America would lead to the eventual destruction of Germany. Hitler also, in Operation Barbarossa, attacked the Soviets for no good reason other than to take over territories which contain large numbers of Jews.
Yeah, I've never thought that or heard it, but it makes a lot of sense and fills in another big piece here. Also, I had a friend whose dad, who's now passed away a few years ago, who was an Italian, who said, why didn't Hitler close the Strait of Gibraltar? That would have thrown a real kink into the Allied war plans.
That's an interesting point. I hadn't considered that.
Yeah, that's brought up by... I've seen that brought out by a number of people since, but... The point is, since Spain was basically favorable, if he would have been guarded that very closely and closed that down by whatever means, I guess you can sink some ships sometimes. I don't know how big that strait is, but you can sink ships and make it difficult to get through, and a bunch of other ways. But that would have really put a wrench into the war plan there. So at any rate, what did in fact happen, whatever the motivation was, that a lot of Jews were put into camps. And then at the end of the war, there was a low-calorie diet as the war moved on, and even maybe during the key war years, a lot of Jews and people working in those camps, which were not exclusively Jews, would die of somewhat malnutrition, being worked to death, and also through disease.
Especially typhus.
Yes, and I think we should mention here, though, that as far as I'm concerned, the idea that there were 6 million Jews gassed or burned to death or electrocuted, because there were three stories originally, is simply preposterous. Now, I always say when I say this that I'm not minimizing the death of even one innocent Jewish person or any innocent person. In a certain sense, the death, the unjust death of every innocent person is an infinite outrage against God. And so I don't mean to minimize it. And I always tell people, we should feel the anguish and the tragedy of even one innocent human being being killed for without just cause, and we would especially feel it if that one innocent person was you or me, you know. So I don't mean to minimize that any person or persons that got caught up in this madness of World War II. But with that said, there is some, we have to have some loyalty to truth as well, and the German people do not deserve to have a lie perpetrated about them like Goldhagen or Hitler's willing executioners and some of these other books that come out and say the entire German population was just relishing killing as many Jews as they could. In fact,
not only that, they make the claim that the Germans are predisposed genetically to hate Jews, and that has been a claim made by Jews repeatedly throughout history.
Yes. So, at any rate, and I'll tell you, I live in Cincinnati. I'm half Irish and Italian, and about fourth Italian, a fourth Welsh, and a fourth German. So I am really not primarily a German individual. But I would say I live in Cincinnati on the west side, which is primarily German-descended people, okay, in Cincinnati, Ohio. You can't get the Germans to care about any of this. I mean, I've tried to rally people to defend ourselves in this country against this Rothschild Zionist cabal. You can't rouse them to care about it. So after living 54 years of life and observing all kinds of people, I do not notice the Germans as being people who want to hurt other people or actually, more often than not, there can be a certain aloofness to the German personality versus maybe the Italian or the Spanish personality. But I've noticed more that Germans do their job, keep society running, do hard work every day, keep things moving, and more often than not, they are taken advantage of by the people around them. I mean, so
you had assimilation rates among Jews and Germans nearing 50% in some places.
Mm-hmm.
And there were only 500,000 Jews in Germany. There was no reason for Germany to go up against the world because of 500,000 people that were living there in 1933 who were assimilating. And it's amazing that in Riggs' book he says that there were 150,000 Jewish soldiers. Now, if you only had 500,000 total Jews in 1933, that would mean that there were probably higher conscription rates among German Jews than there were among German Christians in the Nazi Reich.
Yes, and I believe those were included the half-Jews as well, the soldiers, but it's still an astounding thing. There's a book by a guy who passed away now called Here We Go Again, and the guy's name is escaping me. My memory is not, I haven't reviewed this as recently as I should. I hold it up in the, he was a Canadian, here it is, it's the guy's name is Doug Collins, and he passed away a few years ago. The book is called Here We Go Again, and he recounts in there how a Jewish soldier who had received a medal was visiting his dad in a concentration camp in the middle of World War II, showing the contradictory things that were going on. Here is a book I just pulled off the shelf by Roy C. McBritis. It's called Contemporary Political Ideologies, second edition. And it's used, in the front of the book, it's published by Brandeis University, which is a big Jewish university in the United States. On page 189, and I saved this book because of this passage, page 189, when they're explaining World War II and Nazi ideology and anti-Semitism and racialism, it says at the bottom of page 189, there were only 500,000 Jews in Germany at the time Hitler assumed power over 65 million Germans. That is less than 0.7%. More than 200,000 Jews managed to escape the country by 1938. Those who remained were viewed as a germ just as virulent as botulism. It had to be insulated. They had to be insulated first and then exterminated. Now, I don't know whether the Jewish publishers of this book forgot the script, but here they are telling us that there's only 300,000 Jews, according to this book, left in Germany in 1938, yet we're supposed to believe that Hitler and the Nazis exterminated 6 million. So, of course, they might retort that, well, there were other Jews in Poland and so forth, but my understanding is there were not even 6 million Jews in all of Europe at that time.
Well, and I don't mean to minimize the Holocaust. The Holocaust certainly happened. Jews were terrorized. They were, their lives were torn apart. Many,
they were uprooted, rounded up.
Rounded up, degraded, humiliated, spit upon. It was vicious. It was absolutely vicious.
Yeah.
That said, isn't it amazing that it was Jews and half-Jews like Heinrich who created that entire situation? And
yeah.
I don't believe for a second that it was out of Jewish self-hatred. Because throughout history, Jews have promoted anti-Semitism at periods where the Jews were beginning to assimilate.
I could dovetail or segue into a source there that is very little known that we do mention in the DVD. It's called Joseph of Nasi, N-A-S-I. And this is a book I got from Library Lending, and it's a book published by a Jewish literary society or Jewish historical society. It's a book primarily, I think, by Jews for Jews, and it's about the leader of the recognized unofficial leader of world Jewry in the around 1560, 1570. And in that book, it says that this Joseph of Nasi, who was a very handsome fellow and so forth, he was trying to get the Jews back to Palestine then. And on the island of Crete, he actually helped a leader who was quite an unscrupulous, brutal leader get control of Crete on the promise that he would begin murderous persecution of the Jews so that then Joseph of Nasi and his troops could tell people, we got to leave Crete right now and we're going to go down to Palestine. And they did get some people to leave after the persecution, but it did not work. And that's in that book. Another side note on that book, when we today hear the, right now at this point, the top Jews are apparently aligned with the United States against the Arabs. But in those days, there was the Battle of Lepanto, where the Muslims were invading Europe under the prodding. It makes it clear in the book, under the prodding of Joseph of Nasi and the top Jews of that day, the Muslims were trying to invade Europe to take over Europe, and the Catholics primarily won at that point at the Battle of Lepanto. And while Catholics commemorate this as a great victory for Christianity and European civilization, because it could have been disastrous had Europe lost that battle, in the book Joseph of Nasi, it says that the Joseph of Nasi and them were very depressed over the unmitigated disaster that was the Battle of Lepanto. So that shows you, for Christians or Catholics listening to this who may think, gee, can these guys really know what they're talking about? There's quite a few things in history that are different than you've learned, you know, from the news media or from the History Channel or from the regular history books, you might say.
Now, is that book actually titled The House of Nasi, the Duke of Naxos?
That may be. My memory is, I'm doing everything from memory here with it. I can't put my hands on, and it might be called The House of Nasi. It was all about Joseph of Nasi, though. He was the leader there, but that very well could be. I don't have the title in front of me, I'm sorry to say.
And another good historical precedent is Napoleon Bonaparte, who viewed himself as a messiah, tried to take Palestine for the Jews, emancipated Jews all over Europe, and attacked Russia to free the Jews of Russia. And when he did this, the Jews began to assimilate, and then the Jewish bankers turned against Napoleon and imprisoned him. And they did so at the instigation of religious Jews in Russia who preferred the persecution of the Tsar to the emancipation of Napoleon.
Mm-hmm.
They did not want the Jews emancipated, and they did not want the Jews to leave the ghetto and to assimilate into Gentile societies. It was Jewish racism that consistently throughout history has promoted anti-Semitism.
In fact, that's a very critical point, and you're reminding me of a question you brought up before regarding Rabbi Stephen Wise, who was supposed to be this great advocate of the Jews, and this leads to another source people should know about. He was actually, some non-Jewish congressmen, I guess under the prodding of some Jews, were trying to find a way to get as many Jews as possible out of Hungary or wherever as World War II began to get into 1944 and so forth. Rabbi Stephen Wise and his crowd was going around telling these congressmen, no, don't do anything, just leave it the way it is. And they were talking these congressmen out of doing anything significant to try to help the Jews who were under the the Nazi regime, because of exactly the reasons we've gone through in this whole interview. He knew that they wanted these scenarios to play out. And, of course, Dana Alvey, who is a great advocate for Polish history and still alive in the United States, I think she's in her 70s or 80s, she was in some of the camps after World War II, and she said, right after World War II, everywhere Zionists were running through these camps trying to bribe, persuade, cajole Jews to go down to Palestine.
And Zionist Jews also baited Jews to enter without resistance into the camps. Zionist Jews were always used within the camps and without the camps to comfort Jews and to lie to them and to tell them that they were going to be okay.
Mm-hmm.
And after the war, Zionist Jews performed false flag terrorism in countries like Romania, Hungary, Iraq, Egypt, against Jewish populations to scare them into emigrating to Palestine.
Yes, and the book I wanted to bring up, which is one of the lead punches I always use on people, about this, what Rabbi Stephen Wise and these other Zionists were doing, is a book called Perfidy, P-E-R-F-I-D, Perfidy by Ben Hecht, H-E-C-H-T. Ben Hecht was a Hollywood screenwriter, a Jewish Hollywood screenwriter. He was one of the assistants to David O. Selznick on Gone with the Wind. And I think the movie is called From Here to Eternity. No, it's A Farewell to Arms. A Farewell to Arms, the movie. Right on the screen after the title, one of the screens comes up, and the whole screen is the name Ben Hecht. So, at any rate, the point I want to make here is this whole...
Now, there were trials in Israel regarding the collaboration plan between Eichmann and Kastner to try to...
This is where this book starts out, is an old Hungarian Jewish guy named Martin Greenwald, to anglicize it a little. He was going around the town square there, and is one of the markets in Tel Aviv, I think, or one of the big Jewish cities, passing out his mimeograph sheets about how the two men that you mentioned, Kastner and Becker, this Jewish guy who was Secretary of State for Ben-Gurion was, and the first, he was like Secretary of State of Israel at that time, he had collaborated to keep the Jews in the Nazi concentration camps, that he had kept them there, not tried to get them out.
He worked with Eichmann to ship Jews from Hungary to Auschwitz.
Yes. So the point is that instead of just letting this old man pass out his Xerox, mimeograph sheets, they overreacted and sued him for something or other. I can't remember what, spreading false news, whatever it was. And Greenwald, who was a spunky guy and had almost died himself in the cancer, went and got one of the young Ergen, one of the people who had been in the front lines and taking over Israel. Now, this is a very inflated thing because I don't have any sympathy for the Ergen, but when you read the book, Perfidy, Heck writes it very effectively as though struggling uphill, and so anybody who's ever been in the struggling uphill, you kind of identify a little with what's happening. But this guy takes on the case for Greenwald, and he knew that Ben-Gurion had betrayed a lot of the frontline Ergen when push came to shove in order to make policy or strategic gains for the state of Israel. So he went and nailed this guy in the trial. But the book, basically at the end, Ben Hecht, who had raised a lot of money for the Ergen, he is obviously confused at the end of the book. It was written in 1961, and then it disappeared until like 8 or 9 years ago when technology made it possible to bring every book back into print again. And it disappeared by and large after right as it came on the market. But he's obviously confused by the end of the book, and he's saying, I thought when we had a country, our leaders would be better than the leaders of all the other countries. Our leaders are worse than all the leaders, the ones that are running Israel now. And he basically is kind of saying at the end of the book, what's going on? He talks about a guy named Joel Brandt, I believe, who was imprisoned, who was in England trying to make a deal to get some of the Hungarian Jews out, and he was put in prison till the war was over to stop the deal and all this kind of stuff.
And Eichmann was placed on trial in Israel, and he was captured illegally in South America and sent there in violation of international law. Then the Israelis would not prosecute Zionist Jews who had collaborated with the Nazis. to bring about, they claim, I think, 500,000 Hungarian Jews gassed to death at Auschwitz. So it's complete hypocrisy.
We should mention something, because if people are hearing the subject for the first time, we should tie up on, well, then what was the Holocaust? If we're saying it wasn't 6 million Jews killed, and they were killed basically by starvation and by disease at the end of the war.
And by SS Einsatzgruppen, who would go through and slaughter villages of Jews in Eastern Europe. At least that's the claim.
I'm sorry, I missed what you said there.
The Einsatzgruppen of the SS, who would travel along with the Wehrmacht through Eastern Europe, round up Jews and machine gun them to death in the forests and the villages, and commit other atrocities which took the lives of many Jews who would not have died had not the Nazis taken over Eastern Europe.
And what was the purpose of that?
The purpose of that was to spill the blood of the Jewish people.
I see. Well, of course, but that would fit in with the traditional view of the Nazis of just wanting to kill Jews. You're making another point as well?
Well, I'm certain that I believe that at least 1.5 to 2.2 million Jews did perish in the war who would not otherwise have died.
Okay. And I'm not clear on exactly what the numbers are. But I want to make it... What happened at Auschwitz, though, was that there were three stories initially. One was electrocution, one was burning in ovens, and the other one was gassings. And the gassing story finally won out. But there is... this show is not about this, but as you know, there was the whole idea of the gassings, and that is on the ropes due to the research of Ernst Zundel and others. Robert Farason has asked the Jewish organization since 1974 to simply explain how a gas chamber worked, and he's still waiting for any kind of a response. But what happened was, is as the camps were liberated, and you see a lot of starving people there at the camps. You had cameras were there and film crews were there and filmed those, and those are basically, and a lot of dead bodies that were piled on wagons and so forth. That is what we see, and that is what is used as the basis for the Holocaust, is those pictures. But there's nothing in those pictures to indicate other than that these people were dying of starvation and disease. There never was one autopsy done about a gassing. Why am I bringing that up? Because it's important to not... I don't want to come off in any way like a lot of the neo-Nazis and quasi-Nazi apologists do and try to say, hey, you know, really, you should kind of have a warmer feeling about Hitler when we get done talking here. But it is important to explain what actually happened. For instance, in one of the great Nazi apologists, whose name is Elie Wiesel, who I like to call Elie Wiesel, he has... himself in his writings a lot of absurdities, one of which he has himself being released over the years at three different camps on the same day. He claims that in his first book, which I think was called Night, that he went and he heard testimony from people who said that because so many Jews were buried after being burned, their bones and shirts were buried in certain grounds around Auschwitz, that the people, eyewitness testimony told him that geysers of blood would go up 50 feet in the air out of the ground all day long. You know, it's absurd things like this that are in his initial book.
Is it true that he himself stated that at war's end he had a choice between going with the Nazi Germans or going to the Soviets? And he elected to go with the Germans?
That's what I was going to mention next, because this is Mark Weber at the Institute for Historical Review has an article on this about Elie Wiesel. I think it's called Elie, at least it's under the auspices of Weber. It might be written by somebody else. It's called A False Witness, I think, or Elie Wiesel, False Witness. I think that's what it's called. But in, I believe it was Night Again, the original version, which is can still be gotten, he talks about that as the Russians were advancing on Germany, him and his dad were in a tuberculosis ward, okay? Now, the first question is, if the Nazis are killing every Jew as fast as they can get their hands on them, what in the world are they doing wasting beds in the tuberculosis ward? That's the first question.
Mm-hmm.
So then him and his dad, though, are sitting there thinking, because they're out of the concentration camp, or they're in the medical ward of the concentration camp or whatever, recuperating from the various things, and I think the dad had tuberculosis. And they're talking, and they say, well, now should we... The Germans are about to leave, but they're not forcing people to go with them because the Russians are advancing. Should we wait here for the Russians, or should we go with the Nazis? So start flooding west with the Nazis. And at that point, I usually ask people, what do you think they did? And people say, well, wait for the Russians. And the answer, no. Weasel says they went with the Nazis. So here we are. We're supposed to believe that the Nazis are killing every Jew they can get their hands on. And one of the main Holocaust advocates since 1945, Elie Wiesel, writes that, no, when the push came to shove, his dad and him decided to go with these Nazis that were killing every Jew they could get their hands on. There's so many little preposterous facts like this that don't fit the official story. That
now, the
they
official
need to all
story.
Be brought out and meditated on by people that really want to get a grasp of what was happening in this period of history.
I haven't done much research in that area, and the thought of the concentration camps itself to me is nauseating. But Auschwitz-Birkenau, the revisionists say was not a gassing camp, but I have heard some revisionists, including David Irving, mention the Reinhardt camps like Treblinka, and said that there may have been gassings there. Do you know anything about that?
You know, here's the thing, though. Again, I wouldn't claim I'm reporting on other people's research, basically. But the question has to be on anything like that is how was it done? In other words, if some people turn on their car in their garage and commit suicide because the thing fills up with carbon monoxide, I'm sure that it could be done where that happened to people, but how would it be done with Zyklon B in that, where the Germans who would have pulled them out would have been themselves killed by exposure to the gas? And what an inefficient way! What an inefficient way to do it. The efficient way to do it. I mean, God forbid, all this is ghoulish talk, but is to line up, dig, have a bulldozer dig a hole, line up people in front of it, and machine gun them to death, and push them in the. I mean, that's the efficient way to do it. And so I think Farrasson's, you know, there are people who were at these camps, so like Paul Rassinier, who was a socialist after World War II. He was the one that began a lot of this objection when the top Jews started to push the Holocaust. As a guessing, he was there in Auschwitz, and he said, and in a lot of these camps, I think there are witnesses who said, and the Red Cross, who inspected regularly, you know, so that, this is a whole other show in itself, but, and I'm not really the one that should be doing it, but I do think that Farrasson's challenge, how did one of these work, and no answer to this day, and no answer anywhere on how one of these gas chambers that process 10,000. Another thing Elie Wiesel says in his book is that they killed 10,000 prisoners a day I think he was picking the burning story, but the oven story. And he claimed that every day for 3 years he was always led up to the gate, and always when they quit at 5 or 6 o'clock, he was always in the next batch or the second next batch to go into the gate, but he never was in any of the batches that went in. That's actually in his book.
Read his book, so I can't really comment on any of that. How could they possibly have cremated so many bodies?
Well, that's the point. I mean, it's
wouldn't that require a tremendous amount of fuel?
Yeah, this is what Hutton Gibson got in trouble. The dad of Mel Gibson a few years ago, when he said it would take a gallon and a half of petrol, as he called it. Hutton Gibson's dad, I think, is 88 or 89 now. It'd take a gallon and a half of petrol and an hour and a half to cremate a body. And that was one of Fred Luchter, who helped Ernst Zundel in his trial. Ernst Zundel now being in jail in Germany for questioning the official Hollywood Holocaust story. But Fred Luchter was the head of gas chain, you know, when they killed one person by a gas pellet in Missouri. He was the head of the state execution chamber, and it takes a lot to just the preparation to kill just one person with gas and then wait till the fumes are gone before anybody goes in. So anyway, this is just, again, a subject that people should not swallow whole, the official story. Remember, too, that Churchill, Eisenhower, anyone who wrote any book, who was a major participant in World War II, did not mention anything about the Holocaust in any of those books that came out by any of the major participants.
So, post-war, in the post-war period.
We're talking post-war. And really, the current craze that we're into was not started until 1977, 1978, when the Holocaust miniseries came on television. And then it really began to get rolling. I remember reading a World War II book in high school, and I have it around here somewhere, and it was about all the military campaigns, and I went back and looked at it, and the Holocaust was not mentioned in that book. It was written in the 1960s.
Now, what do you think of the use of the Holocaust as a justification to steal the land of the Palestinians? This is an issue that's been raised by the Arabs again and again, that what occurred in Europe in no way is a justification for the genocide of the Palestinians.
Well, I think it's a good point, and it's a decisive point. And this is why I say that the top Jews were planning to have a Holocaust, because...
And it's also very important to point out that the Zionist movement has been going on ever since the Jews were expelled from Palestine. It was not the Holocaust that created the Zionist movement. It was the Zionist movement that created the Holocaust.
Yes, yes. And so I think that's why I say it was a pre-planned thing. And I'm now, my memory kind of works in... it's like I think of something, and then 25 minutes later, 2 hours later, my brain will spit out what the actual name is. And remember, I mentioned a book that details the attempts after World War One to say that 6 million Jews were killed in World War One, and then they withdrew that quickly. The name of that book is The First Holocaust by Don Hedesheimer, Heddesheimer. It's called The First Holocaust, Jewish Fundraising Campaigns with Holocaust Claims During and After World War One.
And I think so, you can get to that book if you go to my website, jewishracism.com, and go to books, and then go to those books that are published by Germar Rudolph's website.
I think that's available as
a free PDF.
Just so nobody thinks I got a photographic memory, the name Don Hedesheimer just popped in my head. I sat down at Google and put him in, and that's how I got it. And I am looking now at vho.org, which is Germar Rudolph's website. But and what is your website if people want to go to it? What is it?
JewishRacism.com.
Okay, I think you said that at the beginning of the program. Another book we should mention, in case there's any people fluent in the German language out there, because I'm still looking for a translation of this book. It's called Bevor Hitler Kam, B-E-V-O-R, Hitler Kam is K-A-M. It's a German title, and it's a German book still. And it is was put out by a German school teacher named Dietrich Brunder in 1964. And this Jewish school teacher was complaining about the way that the Nazis had treated, you know, the Jews, and I guess he might have been a socialist-leaning Jew, perhaps, as many of these authors are who write about, who I use as sources on that video. A lot of them are screaming and crying legitimately that their people were handed over to Hitler and treated very badly, and the international Jewish establishment stepped aside and watched. But this Brunders, he talks about how all these strands were waiting for someone like Hitler to take over Germany, and that they had been in preparation since the 1880s. And the book allegedly talks about the Jewish ancestry of a number of the top Nazis. Now, I gave this book to Germar Rudolph, who's now also in prison in Germany. He was through Ohio at one point and stayed here for a while. I gave him this book in German, and he used it in some of his publications. But I asked him, I said, after he read at least some of it, did it talk about the Jewish ancestry of top Nazis? And he dodged the question twice. I didn't press it on him any.
Oh, it does. It does. I've read it. It's called Bevor Hitler Kam. It's by Dietrich Brunder. And there are a couple pages. I put them in my book, The Manufacture and Sale of St. Einstein, where he lists the Nazi hierarchy who were Jewish or part Jewish, including...
Oh, well, Brevin, you're the first person that I've been able to get to give me an answer on that. And so that is not your book, The Manufacture of St. Einstein. I ran into that online. That's all online, isn't it?
Yes, it's available as a free PDF at jewishracism.com.
Well, it certainly is worth money. I mean, that is a tremendous work you got there, and I just glanced through some of it. But now, what do you remember what chapter that's in? Because I want to go read that.
If you search for Dietrich Brander's name, you'll find
okay.
it.
Just okay, very good. So that's a very important source. And you, I guess
another source is Henneke Kardell's book, Adolf Hitler Begründer Israels, Adolf Hitler, the Founder of Israel.
Adolf Hitler, the Founder of Israel. And now, do you, I take it you read German then?
Yes.
Oh, good. Okay. Well, this is a so. At any rate, this is a tremendous find for me. So that is what I had heard. And the fellow I mentioned in the tape who put me onto a number of these sources in the late '80s was a fellow named Nord Davis, who passed away now. And he was he ran the North Point team, but he put out a 3 pamphlet series called Star Wars. And he mentioned a number of these books we've been talking about, including Perfidy, and he mentioned that book. But then I have never, in the last 19 years or whatever it's been able to get anybody to actually confirm until now that Brunder did talk about the Jewish ancestry of some of the top Nazis. And, of course, he also was saying, and this is what Gemma Rudolf told me, that he was saying that these strands had been laid in place for someone to pick them up and do what Hitler did, basically, and they had been laid in place since the 1880s. And my mentor on this also says that back from the days of Bismarck, who Spirovanovich, I think his name is, in The Hidden Hand, 100 Mysteries of History, published in 1926, he claims that Bismarck is half... Was also half Jewish.
I have a dictionary that was cited in a newspaper in the 1880s, I believe, that said that Bismarck was a Jew.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Well,
that's also in my book. And Bismarck was heavily under the influence of the Jewish bankers and could have gotten nowhere without them, and they were the ones who made Germany the cohesive force that it was. And also Wilhelm was under the influence of the Jewish bankers and had Protestant preachers who were crypto-Jews.
Yes.
And said after the war that he had been betrayed by the Jews and would not have done what he did had he known that they were setting him up.
As in, I did not know those details that you're just saying, but it fits in with what my mentor told me about this. And, of course, whenever this faction takes over, they always try to centralize everything so the person on the street can't get at anything. In other words, you can't have any influence on anything. And that is that whenever there's this attempt to centralize things in the central national government so that the local and the state or the province have almost nothing to say, this is often the hand in the last 200 years of this these international bankers. And that is Pope Pius XI in one of the encyclicals around 1931 talked about the principle of subsidiarity, which meant have the decisions made at the lowest possible level. In other words, don't have your taxes for your city be made at the national level. But this is the exact opposite of what these Rothschild Zionist-type bankers want. They want everything decided at the national level to where the local people have no say whatsoever because everything is being decided far above them.
Well, a good example of that is in 1913 where they set up the federal income tax and the Federal Reserve System and then initiated World War I, which would throw America deeply into debt so that those debts were secured by the federal income tax and the Federal Reserve banking system, which had debt-based currency, would serve as a perpetual source of income for the Jewish bankers. And enabled them to create the Great Depression where they were able to buy up most of America.
Yes. Wow. Okay.
Now, I did want to ask you about Hess and Himmler and why the Nazis never went for peace. They drove Germany into the ground instead of going for peace, both at the beginning of the war and at the end of the war.
Well, I mean, this would play into the view of things that only a few of us would dare mention, and that is that the whole thing was a big-time wrestling from the start to basically the end by the super criminals who had all been funded up to the top by the Rothschild banking, because there are many. Well, for instance, one of the things I get into in the video is this mysterious trip where Rudolf Hess flew to Germany, flew from Germany to England in 1942 on a peace mission. he was arrested by Churchill. He was going, according to my mentor, there was a group called the Cliveden Group, which was a group of primarily Jews who had become English royalty. English nobility. The Cliveden Group is associated also with something called the Tavistock Institute, which has been used for cultural subversion for many, many years. For instance, it's said by some that the Tavistock Institute was behind the Beatles and the Rolling Stones, that they were looking for talented people that could then be used to push Western society in the wrong direction, and both the Beatles and the Rolling Stones had a major role in making use of hallucinatory drugs and other drugs seem normal. But according to a new book that's out that I have not seen...
Do you know anything about Aleister Crowley and his involvement in that?
I don't, although he's a big occultist, and I think he was associated with it, but I don't really know anything specifically about him and his occult goings-on, although some people, I know there's whole books written about him and so forth. But according to a new book that's out, which I don't know how much to trust, and I haven't seen it, but we mention it here anyway, it's came out since my DVD came out. It's called Hitler Was a British Agent, Hitler Was a British Agent. The title itself makes me think it's primarily disinformation, because the British, for many centuries, have been under the influence of the Bank of London, which is a Rothschild bank. But there probably are a lot of interesting facts in it. I know in that book they claim that Hitler was taken to the Tavistock Institute as a young man and trained how to speak and trained how to, helped him ramp up his speaking ability, shall we say. Although I'm sure, they generally are not going to pick somebody who has no talent to do these things. You know, you're not going to pick somebody we never heard of who can't hardly, who just is a repulsive person to try to make him president. You might pick Bill Clinton.
Had you ever heard of Erik Jan Hanesson, whose real name was Hermann Steinschneider, Hitler's clairvoyant? I think there was a book or a movie.
Oh, yes. This was on the History Channel.
Yes, he was a Jew who taught Hitler how to speak very well and to gesticulate and do other things to control crowds. And
now,
this is factual. This was right before the election, I think.
Yes, here's what... In the cover letter I send out with the DVD, I mention him in there because it was just an interesting fact that came out after we made the thing that came to our attention. But in the History Channel, it said that they had just brought it up again in passing, and they don't explain it or analyze it. But he was looked at to be some kind of a hypnotist, clairvoyant, blah, 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 blah. And they said he told Hitler in 1932 that he would come to power in 1933. To which my question is: was he clairvoyant, or was he just in on the plan? But also, he was found murdered a few months after Hitler came to power in a German forest, and that's what they reported. And they said perhaps it was jealousy of some of the Germans that they didn't want a Jewish person around the Führer. Which is ridiculous, because there were a lot of Jewish people, his cook, his doctors, around the Führer. But it may be that he just was getting out of hand, and they felt that he was becoming counterproductive to what they were doing, and somebody killed, or maybe somebody who's gotten mad at him. But he, this guy was killed a few months after Hitler got into power.
And the whole Hitler family had deep connections with Jews, his sister, his niece, et cetera, et cetera. Isn't that true?
Yes. There's one of the, his half-sister, I think it was Paula, one of those little facts of history that doesn't get swept under the rug, you might say, is in a book called The Jewish Connection by a fellow named, I'm looking at the book right here, it's M. Hirsch Goldberg. It was published quite a few years ago, but he in there says that, he goes into a few pages about Hitler. One of the things he brings out is that Paula Hitler, his half-sister, was ahead of the Jewish literary society or literary club or the Jewish Mensa club or something like that, where she was, and that she at one point had taken a broom and was swinging at the a group of locals who were coming after some Jews or something like that. Well, the second fact is not so significant, but I don't know. Do you put non-Jews at the head of a Jewish literary club? I don't know. But there's all kinds of things with Hitler. For instance, one of the Did you remember the Fuhrer of John Kerry when he was accused by the Swift Boat guys of having gotten his medals not quite by fair play? Do you remember that in the 2004 election?
Yes.
And they said he shot himself with rice or something, or had somebody shoot him with rice, and that was one of the Purple Hearts, things he used to get his Purple Heart. Well, this idea of Jews and half-Jews giving themselves awards in wars goes back a long time. My mentor found that at least one of the two people who got Hitler one of his war medals was Jewish. He was a Jewish soldier in World War One who was above Hitler and did get him. Now, we've never been able to find out about the other person, but that's just a little side fact there. But the book, The Jewish Connection, has a few pages on Hitler. There's also another book called Our Crowd by Stephen Birmingham, which is written in the 60s about the Jewish New York crowd, the high society Jewish New York crowd from the early part of the 19th century. And in that book, he quotes somebody as saying he states that it was well known that one, I think it was Felix Warburg, but again, I could stand correction if somebody looks it up, but I think it was Felix Warburg was helping Hitler and financing Hitler until 1938. So there's all kinds of little tidbits laying all over the joint that when you add them all together, they paint a very different picture.
And wasn't his niece, Angelica, going to bear a child by a Jewish man, and Hitler was also in love with her and murdered her?
I read that, and some of the Hitler apologists say that's a manufactured story, but I think that it's in too many places that she certainly died right at that point.
He had a Jewish chef who could have poisoned him. He had a Jewish doctor, Dr. Morell, who was giving him drug injections.
And it's many
connections to Jews, direct connections.
Oh, very many. And in fact, when he sent I think it was Hungary or Czechoslovakia for a cook in the middle of the war who was Jewish, certain people around him objected, but he overruled them and brought them in. You would think that, you wouldn't expose yourself to Jewish cooks if you were trying to, if it was known that you were around, at least in your office, that you were trying to exterminate all the Jews in the world.
And Ava Brown was an assistant to a Jewish photographer that he had, and she was part Jewish?
I have heard that by anecdotal testimony. My mentor says that, and so does a person I was talking to who's here from Poland, who I just happened to be talking about something else about the vote fraud investigation with her, and she's a teacher. I believe she's a professor, and she mentioned when I brought this up, she said, "Oh, everyone knew that Eva Braun was part Jewish." Now, again, this is anecdotal. But I wasn't prodding her. I just mentioned a few facts about the Hitler and the Jewish connection, you know.
Now, do you believe that Hitler killed himself at war's end and killed Eva Braun?
I do not believe that, because every testimony, even in the 60s when I was leaving grade school and getting into high school, you always heard, it would appear in I'm not going to say tabloids then, but it would appear in certain comic books or publications and certain publications that the mystery of what happened to Hitler, because there was no teeth found, there was no body found. That was standard. That was all I ever heard. And we've already cited that 1953, Otto Strasser and Douglas Reed being one of the most important historians of the 20th century, they just assumed that everybody knew that in their 1953 book that Hitler's body had never been found. Where this came from was in the 1989 archives, when the Soviet Union's quote fell and the archives were released. Then David Irving and others, who relies heavily on our archives and the mainstream press even, touted that there were these pictures of which they showed of, you couldn't tell who it was really, but somebody that looked kind of like Hitler and a woman laying next to him were shot in the head and then burned. And these pictures were supposedly in the Soviet archives. But my point would be, why in the world would Stalin not tout that to high heaven? If they had a Hitler's body, or they had pictures of Hitler's body, and the Soviets were the ones that had discovered it and so forth, why wouldn't they tout that to high heaven? That's ridiculous that they would have put that in secret archives until 1989. There's some stories that Hitler escaped Argentina in a U-boat, others that he went to Spain and died in disguise of stomach cancer. And I think that's what this new book, Hitler Was a British Agent, says. So I don't know. I believe he did not. I believe he got away because there was never. It's just a recent phenomenon where they claim that he was shot, and now you know a lot of the neo Nazis are trying to push that as if it's a fact, you know. But this was nothing. Never heard this when I was growing up.
Going back to Rudolf Hess, he was imprisoned in a very bizarre and inexplicable fashion throughout his life. He was never assassinated. And in the end, what, he committed suicide?
Well, he was 89, and he supposedly committed suicide. Somebody might have just strangled him. Here was the story on Hess, and I knew all these facts, but it was like hearing that Roosevelt had closed the border to the Jews. It was like, what was going on? I mean, for 20 years, I kept these things in my head, thinking what was going on and not really knowing what to make of it. But Hess was captured when he landed. He did not get to the Cleveland Group. He was captured by Churchill, and then eventually he was sent back to be put on trial at Nuremberg. And then he was not, because of course the Holocaust supposedly took place from 1942 to 1945 in earnest, so they couldn't really say he was part of that because he was in prison in England. So then after the Nuremberg trials, he was imprisoned in Spandau Prison, which is spelled S-P-A-N-D-A-U, I think, Spandau, maybe just A-U, Spandau Prison. And he was the only person in there from like 1945 till 1989 when he died in his 90s. The strange thing, the fact that I knew that, I thought, what in the world is this all about? Every month, soldiers would march around this prison like 24 hours a day or, you know, all the time guarding it. 1 week the Russians took it, 1 week the Americans, 1 week the British, and 1 week the French, and they would rotate. 1 week a month for 89 years, for 44 years. So I'm thinking, what's going on? Well, my mentor told me what was happening here, and it's the same reason they kept Adolf Eichmann in a soundproof booth at Nuremberg, at the trial in Israel in 1961 when they put Adolf Eichmann on trial. Hess was according to my mentor, Hess was a, and according to John Coleman, who incidentally is allegedly a British intelligence agency who's now begun informing the public of a lot of things in the last 20 years. Coleman says the same thing. He was there as a warning to all the high-level people in Britain, Germany, and elsewhere that anybody who exposed, like in the, this would have been very damaging to expose all this in the 50s and 60s. Right now, we might even think that the powers that be want to let this out. I mean, they are, a lot more is coming out about this in recent years. And somebody said the 50-year, how do they put, or the 60-year moratorium is being lifted by the ruling elite on this issue since 2005. But I might have lost my train of thought there. I shouldn't have got off on that tangent. But the Spandau Prison. He was sitting there for 44 years, guarded by four countries in rotation, all alone in a prison that held 300 people, because he was a warning to all the high-level people who knew about all the stuff we're talking about tonight and the transfer agreement. And as a warning, anybody that talks is going to get this fate or worse. That's what my mentor says he was doing there. And Coleman says, and that makes more sense than anything else I've heard, because without that piece of the puzzle, what in the world was going on there? Hello?
That was a very weird situation.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. That's the first time I ever heard anything that made any sense at all regarding.
Well, they had no ground, legitimate grounds to hold him.
Doesn't seem like it. Oh, another thing, and this is well known from the writing of his son, who died of an aneurysm shortly after he died. He was never, ever in those 44 years allowed to talk to his wife or his kid, or his son, who was a grown man, of course, and for much of that time, without government agents being present to monitor the conversation.
And has his family ever spoken out about it?
Well, they objected to it. I don't know that they knew. I don't know what they knew, but I don't know what they made of it. They were objecting and trying to get him freed and trying to get and objecting to this close monitoring of every word that they said to him.
Wasn't there a 60 Minutes special or something I seem to remember in the 70s?
There may have been. I never heard of that or saw it. I never even heard of it till you just mentioned it.
It's a vague memory that I have.
Okay.
I seem to remember seeing the prison and seeing Hess, but picture images of a young Hess.
And let's not forget, since we've been talking about Jewish connection to Hitler, his lawyer Hans Frank.
His father also, I think, was a famous lawyer, and he was vicious to people in Poland. He became the director of Poland.
Uh-huh. Well, Frank was part Jewish, and he was executed at Nuremberg. Now, this is another thing that indicates, though, somewhat of a tension between the various factions, because the fellow who told me about all this says that